time to unleash your inner cowboy with the Earn Your Spurs podcast. Now, here's your host, Alyssa Barnes.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to episode number 4 of the Earn Your Spurs podcast. Today, my featured guest is a self-proclaimed city slicker. His name is Graham Menzies, and he has written an ebook called The Rodeo Guide for City Slickers. I think regardless of whether you are a city slicker yourself, an actual honest-to-God cowpuncher, or somewhere in between, you're going to enjoy this episode. Not only do we talk about Graham's book, but we also get to hear Graham's perspective on urban versus rural life, and I think what he has to say is really, really valuable. So without further ado, let's go ahead and get started. Hello, Earn Your Spurs listeners. I'm excited to introduce you to my guest today. His name is Graham Menzies, and he wrote a book called The Rodeo Guide for City Slickers. In The Rodeo Guide for City Slickers, Graham brings his urban credentials and experiences to the task of explaining rodeo to other urban professionals in a way that is light, lively, informative, and accessible. A communication strategist and writer, Graham played a leadership role on the communications team at the 2010 Olympic Games and continues in his commitment to telling the true stories of athletes and athletics through his immersion into all things rodeo. Combining personal rodeo attending experience with solid research and consultations with actual rodeo performers and professionals, Graham introduces the city slicker to rodeo as only a true city slicker can. Born in Western Canada, he has visited over 100 cities around the world and has lived on 3 continents. He has an honors degree in international relations and a master's degree in communications and technology. And while you could say he has lived a modern and urban life, the true definition of a city slicker. Graham, why don't you tell us a little more about your backstory and how a self-proclaimed city slicker developed such a keen interest in rodeo?
And thank you for having me on the podcast. It's
absolutely.
I appreciate the opportunity to meet you and talk to you and to anyone else who might be listening.
Yeah, glad to have you.
Thank you for the lengthy introduction.
Absolutely.
I think that covered all the bases. I think, as we were chatting a little earlier before, I live in British Columbia now. I'm from Alberta originally. And as the bio says, I've been around a few other places. But I think one of the things that moved me towards writing this book was my Olympic experience. And so when I was working on the Vancouver 2010 Winter Olympic Games, I was starting to learn a lot more about sports and being a lot more curious about sports in a way that being involved for an organization like that forces you to do. And I thought, one of the funny things about Olympics is that every 4 years, you get this massive amount of interest. Like millions and millions and millions of people from all over the world tune in on TV, and they go on their websites and all kinds of conversation. It all becomes about Winter Olympics for 2 weeks, and then it goes away. It just evaporates. And I thought, I'm thinking of my own experience, it's kind of a little bit like the Calgary Stampede. And for that matter, I think there's lots of other events. So the National Finals Rodeo or any of the other big ones, or maybe even some of the smaller ones, they happen for a short period of time, periodically, maybe once a year. And people come from far and wide, and they go and they attend, and they think it's fascinating, and then they all go away again. And I thought, well, that's kind of an interesting parallel. And then the other thing was, just as I was working with the Olympics, I got to know and meet a number of Olympic athletes and talk to them. And as I met rodeo athletes and talked to them, I thought, this is kind of surprising. There's quite a lot of similarities. And in some cases, as I say in the book, there are actually, I found a couple Olympic athletes who actually are also rodeo athletes, or who grew up on a ranch and bring a lot of that values and that experience, that hard work and the persistence and the dedication and the training, but also that aspect of their lives where they can be famous for a moment and then history very shortly thereafter. They have to self-fund a lot of the time. Their ability to continue performing is in many ways depending on their success and their ability to get sponsored. And I was kind of surprised that I was finding so many of these parallels. And I thought, I don't think other people like me really are aware of this at all. And so there's this whole sport event out there in rodeo that, in my view, is on par with like the Olympic experience. And it seems to be kind of a secret. And I thought, wow, I kind of need to. I'm intrigued by that personally, and I just needed to research it some more. But then I thought I need to share it as well.
Yeah.
That's part of the reason for getting into this.
Yeah. So what is the book really about? Can you kind of give us an overview of it?
Well, you know, it started off as just trying to provide some sport explanations. You know, so what is bareback, what is bronc riding, what is roping all about? Because I go back to the Olympics, I think of figure skating. You know, people, you watch figure skating on TV and you're witnessing obviously a high level of athletic performance, and you're thinking to yourself, why did that person win and the other one didn't? Like, is twirling twice in the air better than twirling three times? I don't understand. I'm impressed, so but true. I don't understand. And I thought, you know, it's difficult. It was difficult to actually find that information in one place. You could find bits of it here and bits of it there, but it was so that the bull riding stuff is all over on the bull riding sites and the bronc site information on the bronc sites. Sometimes they're kind of different and they're written sort of differently. I just thought, you know, that there seems to be an opportunity to bring all that together and put that together in a consistent kind of format and easy to understand. There's rough stock events and not rough stock events. There's roping events and, you know, just kind of explain that and then explain what are the judges looking for? What's the significance of that buzzer or that siren going off? How do you get points? How do you lose points? I didn't even know you could lose points, you know? So just to explain that. And then the other thing that's in there too was just around the equipment. Because as a city slicker, you think, well, you know, horse with saddle. Those are your options. As I looked into it, I thought, well, there's different kinds of saddles, you know, and there's different kinds of horses.
Right.
And even for the ropers, they've got different saddles from the people that are doing saddle bronking. And why are they different? How much do those things cost? But it's like sports, other sports. You realize there's different. I mean, the training equipment on the ropers was a revelation. Like, I'd never heard of Helomatic. And I'm like, what? They've got robot cows? That's crazy. But it's fascinating. And it's the same thing when you look at some of the other less mainstream sports. You see what other athletes do with their training regime, and it's really kind of fascinating.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you brought up the parallel with the Olympics, and actually I'd love to hear about some of the people who come from a ranching background that you got to know throughout your Olympics experience. But one thing I just wanted to mention was, I mean, when you look at the Olympics and you look at rodeo, you can really see that the people who are involved in it have a true passion for what they're doing. It's not about the money, really. Yeah. You know, it's not like pro basketball players that are out there making millions of dollars a year. It's these people are dedicated, and there's a few people that make money at it, and there's a whole lot of other ones that don't. So you know that the ones that are involved are really, really serious about what they're doing.
Yeah, no, I think that was really fascinating to discover that parallel and something I wanted to share. So just to try and stick to your question.
Yeah.
Sorry, I rambled a little bit there.
No, that's fine.
The initial part was sort of just to explain the sports, to sort of explain what's going on when I go to a rodeo. What is it that I'm seeing and how is this all working? But then that did actually lead to talking to some of the athletes and talking about how they train and how they prepare and how they think and what books do they read and what music do they listen to get themselves psyched up and where do they come from and how did they get started in this. But I layered on, I wanted to flesh it out a little bit more there. So there's a chapter which is kind of about the history of rodeo, which was I really enjoyed writing and researching, especially as a Westerner, because in addition to there being an urban-rural thing, there's also a kind of Westerner-Easterner thing that comes into play sometimes. And I found when you looked at the history of rodeo in a sort of cultural, historical context, you find that there's a whole lot of stuff there that people would be surprised to know about. So the involvement of black cowboys, you know, that I think most urban people, particularly those maybe on the eastern side of the continent, have this notion that folks out west are kind of, you know, backwoods people that are unsophisticated and sort of lagging behind in cultural and social reforms. And I'm like, right. Well, not so much, actually. It turns out that Westerners are actually leading in many cases. So there are black cowboys and black ranchers that are, you know, active and involved in the sport and in ranching a long time ago. So before there were black athletes in the NBA, there were black athletes in rodeo. Mm-hmm. Award-winning, you know, champions, right? Same thing with women. There were women involved in rodeo sports before there were women involved in Olympic equestrian events. So in terms of access and openness and equality, those things actually started more in the West. Even the vote, I think women had the vote in Montana, Idaho, and Manitoba, all before the national governments gave women the vote. So at the state and provincial level, a lot of these reforms came in initially in the West and then were adopted subsequently by the national governments. And in the course of time, I think people sort of forget all that. And they think that was all invented in the big cities by all the mm-hmm. smart people, and that everyone else in the countryside is lagging behind. So there was lots to discover there, from sort of a social and cultural. And that led to a chapter on country music, which was a lot of fun to write. And I also developed like little mini chapters on trivia and definitions and explanations of things. So how to tell the difference between what's a cow and what's a calf and what's a mare and a stallion and what's the difference between a pony and a mule and all these sorts of things, right? That normal urban folks just don't know.
Right. Yeah, I think that's great, because just like anything, you know, we have our own terminology, and if you're on the outside looking in, it can seem like a foreign language. Well, yeah.
People will talk about, you know, driving over the line, right? And they're like, what line? Oh, the border. Okay.
You know, yeah.
The guy's on the blacktop, and I'm like, well, the blacktop? What's the blacktop?
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting that you mentioned the social implications, because, I mean, that's not something that I really ever think about. You know, it's a part of our history, but it's just sort of, I don't know. It's interesting to think that the West and sort of backwoods folks, that, you know, the rural country folks are the ones that kind of started the whole equality thing, and maybe they didn't start it. Maybe it was just like that to begin with, you know?
Well, I think, you know, part of it is probably just practical realities of frontier life mm-hmm. and rural life. If you need somebody that can swing a hammer, what do you care what their gender
right.
is
or
what
right,
their
exactly.
color is, so long as they know how to swing a hammer. So, you know, the harsher aspects of frontier life, but also of ranching farming life, wash away a lot of those kinds of barriers, because people just right. need to get stuff done, and people need to get along. And when there's a few of you and you have to depend on each other, you learn how to get along pretty quick. So
right.
that's where that, my theory anyway, is kind of where that comes from.
I agree with you. And you sort of prove yourself by what you do and how hard you work and just your character. And I mean, that's kind of all it takes yeah. to prove yourself with those types of people.
Well, and then that's the other thing I find so fascinating about rodeo is because that's pretty much the cowboy ethos, right?
Right.
Like,
absolutely.
It's you and the bull, or it's you and the whatever the sport event is. And it kind of doesn't matter what you did yesterday.
It
doesn't really matter who you're related to. It doesn't really matter so much what you've studied. It matters what you're able to do at the moment and how you've been able to prepare for that. And that's what wins the day. That's very much a sort of a cultural attitude of Western part of our continent. Even in some of the bigger cities in the West, too, they still sort of share that attitude and that approach towards things. But I just think it's fascinating that there's a connection between that kind of cultural thinking and a particular sport. I can't think of any other sport that is as connected to its geography and its civic life in the way that rodeo is. It's the same thing, by the way, with regard to music. I mean, there are, you know, Chris LeDoux, even George Strait. Those are artists who know how to ride horses and participate in rodeo events. Name one other artist that sings about, I don't know, football, hockey, basketball, who is also a basketball player. I mean, it's just, it never happens. It's a unique phenomena to that whole rodeo cowboy culture.
It gives the music a whole lot of meaning because they're singing from their hearts.
Yeah. And they sing about, I mean, there are songs about rodeo. There are songs about cowboys. There's movies about, lots and lots of movies about cowboys. Lots of books and stories. So you've got literature, you've got song, you've got film, you've got sculpture, you've got painting, all these things around the cowboy life and the ranching life and the rodeo life. There's no other sport that has that impact on arts and culture. So I guess that's going back to the book. One of the things I'm trying to do with that is connect the dots, show the connections between these things and try and pull people together. So try and bring the East and the West a little bit closer together in terms of understanding why we're different and how we're different, but also between the rural and the urban people to show that there's things that we have in common here and there's things that we can learn about each other. And just trying to connect the dots on a few of those things and maybe provoke some thinking.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So on that topic, what has been the response to your book from those who have read it?
Well, that's the funny thing. The best response I've had has actually been from rural people.
Mm.
So that was,
they like bridging that gap.
Well, I don't know if they like, they do. I mean, I get a lot of encouragement from them. When I speak to folks that are like rodeo cowboys or athletes or involved in hosting and staging these types of events, they're very excited and enthusiastic about the idea of having more urban people come to the events and understand the events. So I get a lot of encouragement that way. I think that's probably been the largest audience of book readers as well, has been the rural folks. But I guess I shouldn't be surprised because those are where the fans are. So those would be the ones that would be most interested in it. I've got more work to do to try and reach out to urban folks and pass that along. It is still very much like that Olympic experience where people will pay attention to it and they'll have interest to it when the rodeo is happening. And then they sort of forget all about it. Mm-hmm. So there's some peak opportunities where they may have some interest in it, but then as the events move on, they lose interest in there. So there's some work to do there. And certainly if your listeners want to tell your urban friends about it, I don't know if you've got urban friends or relatives in the city that are scratching their heads thinking, why are you so into this? Send them a link. The book is free. So it costs them nothing, and hopefully it's somewhat entertaining and worth a read. But try and share it with your urban friends and invite them to learn more and help them understand what this is all about.
Yeah. That's, I mean, the book is great. I've read through it, and that's part of what I'm trying to do here with this podcast and with the earnyourspurs.com blog is to reach out to those people who might have somewhat of an interest in rodeo or in learning to ride or whatever the case may be, but just don't really know how to get started. And they need a little, they need some information and some help to kind of get there. And so I think your book is a great resource for that. And it's actually right. You can find a link to it right on the homepage of earnyourspurs.com. And I'll also put a link to it in the show notes for this podcast episode. So anybody who's listening can check it out and go download it and read it. And there's some pretty neat features in there in addition to, you know, you go through all the rodeo events and whatnot, but you also look at some things like cowboys and social media. I mean, you can find any cowboys Twitter handle that you want to follow in your book. And you talk a little bit about fashion in there, which is neat too. So do you want to go into some of your views on fashion for maybe someone who wants to go check out a rodeo for the first time?
Sure. Well, I'm not, I'm certainly not an expert on fashion. I'm probably a typical guy. I think a friend of mine once said, what is it that he said? Something like, you know, women put on an outfit, men just get dressed. So that's kind of how it is for me. But, you know, I did, there are some, like, you would think no-brainers, but I thought it's worth putting in the book. So there's some good things to avoid doing. So, like, wearing flip-flops is not a good idea. You know, there's animals around. they're heavy. There's also lots of people around, right? So you want to protect your toes, and there's also other stuff on the ground that you might not want to step in. So boots are not just a fashion accessory. You know, there is a practical aspect of that. I appreciate, though, that boots can also be expensive. But I mentioned a couple places where you can go get boots or discover boots. There are actually websites all about cowboy boots. There are books about cowboy boots if you really want to get into it. But the practical advice is don't wear flip-flops, you know. Hats, you got to wear one. I mean, even if it's a ball cap, you know, wear a hat. Try not to wear it backwards if it's a cowboy hat. But you see that, right? You see that if you go to rodeos, you see some folks wearing their hat on backwards. So just a little tip, you know, if you look at the ribbon on the inside of the hat band, the ribbon always goes at the back. That's how you can tell.
Very good. You know, very good pointer there.
Pointer. And, you know, if it's summertime, you might want to do the straw variety. They're not only cheaper, they breathe a little easier. That sort of thing. Also some advice to, you know, not overdo it, because then you can look like a bit of a dandy and become a bit of a joke. And you also get really, really hot, you know? You look like a rhinestone cowboy, and you got your Wranglers and your big, heavy shirt with all the buttons and stitching and your felt hat. And you know, some people go buy a brand new pair of boots and then think they're going to walk around for 5 hours. That can be pretty hard on the feet, you know? You get some big blisters. So some warnings, some really practical advice there. I think the ladies are lucky. Because to my observation, ladies can wear pretty much anything and look good. You know, you just put a cowboy hat on and you look great. You know, girls can wear cowboy boots and shorts. Guys cannot wear cowboy boots.
Yeah, that's a bad idea.
There's some other little advice like that. Girls have a lot more choices, which on the one hand, I guess, is good. On the other hand, it must be overwhelming. But I do include also on the at rodeo guide Twitter handle, I've got a few lists. I don't know if folks are into lists, but I found some fashion type folks through that are on Twitter, and I just created a list. I don't know how many are there now. It's probably 20 or 50 or somewhere in that range. But in the course of my research, I occasionally found some folks that are great at jewelry. Some people make their own jewelry. Some people do belt buckles. Some people do hand-tooled leather. Some people do, you know, blankets and home decor. And whenever I found those, I just sort of added them to the list. So you can go on there and find that list and then sort of poke around, and you can find all kinds of people that are creating some neat stuff either to wear or to, you know, decorate your home with.
That's very cool, because there's certainly a lot of people making some unique things out there that not everybody has access to. So
yeah,
that's a great resource. So you recently put out a revised version of your book. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what you added and why.
Yeah. Well, you know, I the real driving motion, kind of going back to your earlier question about what do urban folks think about the book, often enough for me to notice, people would say, I'm kind of interested in rodeo, but, you know, I'm a little concerned about animal welfare. I hear stuff, you know, and I'm not sure what I think about that. And I got that often enough that I thought, ugh, I'm going to have to do a chapter on that. Yeah. I left it out of the first edition because I just, you know, I kind of felt that didn't really need to be gone into. I just wanted to talk about the sport and the culture and all those other fun things. But that did seem to be something that needed to be addressed. So it's probably now the longest chapter in the book. It's something that's very difficult to do in a short way, especially for urban people whose main exposure to animals are their pets. You really have to sort of back up. At least I felt I needed to sort of back up a little bit. And let's talk about sort of how we got to be to where we are. It didn't used to be like this. This is probably, you know, maybe the first, perhaps in some cases, the second generation that has no experience of livestock. But 100 years ago, it was quite different. I'm the youngest of my family, and I'm now middle-aged, regrettably. But my dad used to, one of his first jobs was, he had a summer job, I think, as a milkman. And that was a horse-drawn carriage. I mean, he had a horse, and he used to tell stories about the horse knew the route better than he did. And he used to have to try and keep up with them, because the horse would go ahead and it would stop at one house for, you know, 30 seconds, and then it would move on to the next. And dad had to try and keep up. But the point is, I have parents that that knew horses. He grew on to become a scientist and got involved in the oil business and traveled all over the world and lived a very urban life. But 100 years ago, or even a generation ago, people had firsthand experience of livestock, knew how to pluck a chicken, knew how to ride a horse, just basic stuff like that. And we now have a generation that has no idea. So I had to start that chapter just really high level and sort of walk people in through the history and the purpose. People think that there are just horses. There aren't just horses. There's thoroughbred horses. There's draft horses. There's all, just like there are sheepdogs and there are Yorkie dogs. They're different kinds of animals, and they are bred genetically to do different kinds of things. And it's not fair to keep a sheepdog in an environment where it can't get out and do sheepdoggy things. And it's also not fair to keep a thoroughbred horse in a stall, unable to go out and do thoroughbred-y things. But you really have to sort of back up and put that stuff into context. So that took a lot of work. But I learned a great deal. And I uncovered a lot of facts that just really kind of fly in the face of some of the arguments that the animal rights activists and even some of the animal welfare activists will put out there. Even in my own case, at the beginning of this process, I didn't really understand the difference between animal welfare and animal rights. So for other urban people, you know, I think it was helpful for me to be able to say, okay, there's two kinds, right? There's the welfare guys and there's the rights guys. And the welfare guys believe in this, that, and the other thing. And the rights guys believe in these things. So when you're going to a rodeo or you're going to some kind of livestock event and a protester comes at you, you have to think to yourself, okay, is this the welfare argument or is this the rights argument? Because those are different things, and you need to sort of understand that before you can engage in any kind of conversation or dialogue about the issues. So that's really the big piece on there. in the new book. I was able to go in and update some of the athlete profiles and sort of rewrite that a little bit, because I had the chance to speak with more cowboy athletes after I wrote the first one and do the second one. So I was able to flesh that out a bit more, and I redid the country music bit, which also took quite a bit of research, but was also really fun research to do. I didn't know, for example, so here's a little bit of trivia for you, Bill Haley and the Comets, that big rock and roller, right? He was a yodeling champion.
Yeah, I didn't know that either.
He used to be, I'll have to read the book, see if my memory's not that good, but it was like Bill Haley and the, I don't know, the Saddlemen. I think it was Bill Haley and the Saddlemen was his first group, and he was actually a state champion yodeler. This is back in the day when, you had the Roy Rogers and others that, used to do the yodeling in the country songs. But he started off, with the boots and the hat and the yodeling. Many of these other guys also started off as big rock and rollers that ended up working at, playing at Sun Records, at Johnny Cash, Elvis, Jerry Lee Lewis, Roy Orbison. You think of, the guys that started the rock and roll movement, they all were influenced by country music, and they all started off as country musicians. So that was fun to rewrite that chapter as well.
Yeah, I bet. That's pretty interesting stuff. I'm curious about like your research process for the book and the people that you met along the way. What was the most rewarding part of that process for you while you're researching and writing the book?
I think just being able to, really just connecting the dots. I guess it's almost in some cases a little bit like a mystery novel, at least for me. I don't mean the book, but for me it was like problem solving. And I think that's maybe the value of the book, is that it takes a lot of research about different topics and sorts it out and puts it together and explains it in pretty short, easy to read format for people. So I enjoyed the investigative aspect of it, to try and, put some of the pieces together and see why things are relevant or why they have any kind of meaning or what they have in common and why an urban person would find any of that of value or of interest in it. So it was partially just curiosity on my own part. But when you go to the process of investigating all that stuff and putting it all together, it seems a waste not to share it. So I think the book format is a great way to put the result of the research and the curiosity together in a way that maybe other people can understand it and enjoy it and save themselves hundreds of hours of poking around online, right, trying to find answers to stuff.
Trying to learn.
Well, that's one of the other things, forgive me for just sort of blabbing on a little bit.
No, go ahead.
One of the other things with the rodeo stuff is you don't have an NHL. There's no National Hockey League. There's no National Football League. It's not no International Olympic Committee, no Fédération Internationale de Sport. There's no big governing body. So when you're trying to learn about it, there is no single source that you can go to. And even on the animal welfare stuff, each rodeo has its own policies and it has its own committees and it has varying degrees of commitment to that. So there is no single place to go for that. So what I've had to do is kind of cast a broad net and look in and speak to lots of different people and then try and pull it all together. So hopefully the book does a bit of that.
Yeah, I think, the PRCA tries to cover a lot of that information. But when you're in Canada, I mean, neither of the big rodeos that we talked about earlier, Calgary or Cloverdale, neither of those are even sanctioned by the PRCA anymore.
Yeah.
So you're looking at two, and obviously there's several other rodeos up there as well, but Calgary being the Calgary Stampede being the biggest, they get to make up all their own rules because it's their own independent deal. So
yeah, and that's part of the beauty of it too. You know, imagine if football was done that way.
Yeah.
You know, on the one hand, you'd think that was chaos. And on the other hand, you think that could be really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
if
people got to sort of make up their own rules a little bit, depending on where they were and what they thought was appropriate for their audience.
I'm guessing you probably still go to a lot of rodeos around Canada to just take in the sights. Do you have a lot of opportunities to talk to people while you're there? I mean, I've found just personally that a lot of people that go to rodeos just go for the sort of experience of it, and they may not really understand what's going on. And obviously your book addresses that. But I sometimes overhear people talking to their friends about, for instance, an animal welfare misconception. And so I sort of feel like it's my responsibility to correct them whenever possible. You know, I'll hear somebody saying, oh, yeah, that's, you know, they make them buck because they tie their genitals or whatever. Right. And I said, well, actually, that horse that you're looking at right now is a mare. And, you know, and I try to explain to them that that's actually, you know, not the case. So I wonder if you've had any experiences like that.
Well, not actually at rodeo events. It's difficult. It's a little awkward when some of that comes up on the event. I guess it's the book's maybe my passive aggressive way of saying, hey, you know, I would like to disagree with you. Please go to this link. I will leave now before you hit me. But I did get into it a little bit this past summer, where predictably around the Calgary Stampede, there's always a protest. And there was a couple of young ladies that came out and chained themselves by the neck to the chuck wagon track. And
I saw pictures of that.
Point. And that was an opportunity, actually, to engage with some folks on through social media. And it was interesting. Some people just don't want to know. They're happy to be against something, whether they understand it or not.
Right.
But I did find some people that were actually willing to learn and have a bit of a discussion around that. And that was kind of fun. And it was a good opportunity too, to present facts. It's very often an emotional discussion. And that's what happens too, when you're at an event, that's why I'm always cautious too, because it can get emotional. When people get emotional, things can get out of hand. But I like the idea of being able to provide some facts and statistics and things, and to say, well, you know, whether you approve of it or not, the injury rates are actually very, very low compared to other sports that involve animals. So my argument would be, if you really want to make a difference, you should probably bark up another tree, because this is not where the problem is. This is actually where it's funny that people don't get this, but it just seems obvious to me, although it has to be explained, that people that work with livestock all year long actually are very good at caring for livestock. The real offenders are people that don't work with livestock very well or very often. And those are where you have people that make mistakes or treat them in ways that are inappropriate. But you do have to kind of, you know, you do have to sort of put your logic and your reason and your facts together, and before people will begin to be persuaded that this is not an emotional thing. And again, I think a lot of that is kind of a cultural, social thing. A lot of the people that are critical of rodeo from an animal rights or welfare point of view are people don't seem to have noticed it, but they seem to be urban people. And I'm thinking, you know, this is not about animals. This is actually about urban and rural. You're just assuming that all you rubes out there with your rednecks and whatnot just don't understand how to be sophisticated and progressive, and you're not with it anymore. If you were with it, you would understand that, you know, that's a archaic, old fashioned form of life. But that's really an attack against a lifestyle. It's got nothing to do with how animals are treated. So I'm trying to make those arguments when I engage with people, is to help them think through what they're saying a little bit and say, do you realize that your arguments really don't have anything to do with facts? Well, they seem to have quite a bit to do with some assumptions, perhaps even prejudices around the kinds of people that are involved in that. It's actually anti-culture than anti-animal in many cases. Mm. And that's really sad. And the saddest part is I think a lot of them don't even realize it.
Mm-hmm. That's a really interesting way to put it. I've actually never heard it explained that way. And you know, when you think about it, that's really true. I mean, it is an attack against a lifestyle. It's one segment of the population thinking that they know better than this other segment of the population who's been living this way for 100 years or more, a couple hundred years maybe, and thinking that they know better how to care for animals than these people that do it every day. Yeah, no,
the good news is, I think we're also getting at a place in cities where people are beginning to have an interest and maybe even a bit of a longing to reconnect with a more authentic way of life, shall we say. So you do see people like urban coops. It's a bit of a trend now. It's popular in Vancouver. You can get a license and from the city hall, and you can keep chickens in your backyard, you know, so long as it meets certain criteria. But people like the idea of raising their own chickens and making their own, getting their own eggs. There's also people that are doing some urban farming. There's collectives where people work together and say, well, you guys do strawberries and we'll do blueberries and we'll do carrots and you do cabbage. And then we'll have an urban farmers market meeting on the weekend and everyone will bring their produce. There's a great deal of interest in organic food. People are paying a lot more attention to what they're eating. I've seen in Portland, the name skips me at the moment, but there's an organization down there that teaches butchery. So people think, well, I can go to the supermarket and I can get my flank steak or my ribeye, but I have no idea what you're talking about. So I want to learn what is a flank? Where does that come from? What part of the animal are we talking about? And why is that good or why is that different? And how do I cut that? And you can actually take classes at night where you can go in and you can slice up a piece of meat somehow or other. And then you cook it and you make food out of it and eat it. And people in cities are beginning to have interest in that's now a new learning experience. Like I was saying before, my parents or perhaps listeners' grandparents' generation already knew that stuff. But now it's discovery. And people are learning how to go out in the wilderness. There's shows like Bear Grylls, Survival, you know. There's the Duck Dynasty, which is wildly popular. I think a lot of people in cities are interested in reconnecting with the land and with food and with animals. And there's an interest to learn more there. So that's the good news.
Right. Yeah, it's great when people want to learn more about where their food comes from rather than just, you know, thinking that it materializes on the grocery store shelf.
Well, my favorite one was when I was doing some of the research and I was reading some quotes from Temple Grandin. And she's got that one quote. Quoting there by some kids in California that thought eggs grew in the ground like potatoes.
Oh my God. I've never seen that one. That's great.
And she had another example of a guy that you know, got all angry with her because he just didn't think it was right that you should strip the skin off a cow for its leather and then let it grow another layer of skin so that you can harvest again the next year. And that's when you really back up and say, wow, you know. Yeah, people have lost touch.
Right.
And you really need to sort of back it up a little bit and help people reconnect with the world, life.
That's so true. Yeah. Oh, well, thank you. This has been awesome. I just have one final question for you, Graham. Mm-hmm. And it's the one that I ask all of my guests to kind of close out the show, and that is, what do you think is the most important quality for any good cowboy to have?
Well, after I answer, I'm going to go to your website and I'm going to listen to all the ends of all the podcasts so I can see if I get the answer right. I think it's integrity. That's the one thing that kind of blew me away a little, really, when I was speaking to cowboy athletes, saying, wow, every one of these men and women have such integrity, honesty, values, belief in themselves, a belief in doing the right thing, you know, whatever that means to them, but very clear sense of integrity. I didn't find anybody that had any doubt about themselves or what they were doing. And I think that's an incredibly attractive quality for cowboys to have. And I don't think they have to try to have it. I think they just do.
I think it's probably goes along with just the passion they have for what they're doing and the character that's behind it. So
yeah,
they don't have any question about who they are or what they're all about.
So. And again, I think that's a great thing for urban people. You know, when you go to work or you read the paper and you hear about this CEO or that CEO or this Wall Street guy and this all kinds of shysters and folks that are doing all kinds of deals and it can be kind of depressing. And you start to question, you know, is there any room left in the world for people of integrity? And so my answer is maybe it's time to take a break, go out in the countryside and take in a rodeo and talk to some of the people that are there. You'll come back actually feeling spiritually refreshed.
Yeah.
So I think that's something, one of the reasons why I'd like to help more urban people dial in, tune into the rodeo experience.
Well, that's awesome. Thank you so much for being here today, Graham. This has been a great conversation. And as I mentioned before, we'll have a link to your ebook in the show notes, and it's already on the website for anybody that wants to check it out and download it and read all about it. And then where else can they find you?
They have a website, which is therodeoguide.com. If you go there, that's pretty much got the links to everything else. The Twitter handle is @rodeoguide.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Graham.
Thank you. It's been great to meet you and talk to you. I love your website, and I've really enjoyed the conversation. And thanks, everybody, for your support.
I hope you enjoyed that episode of the Earn Your Spurs podcast. I really got a lot out of my conversation with Graham, and I hope you did as well. If you haven't checked out his book yet, feel free to hop on over to earnyourspurs.com and download a copy for yourself. It's a great read and especially valuable for someone who wants to know more about rodeo and might benefit from having it explained by someone that has a similar perspective. I am also going to work with Graham to see about getting an audio version of the book, so be looking for that as well. If you enjoyed the episode today and feel so inclined, I would really appreciate a little review love on iTunes. It only takes a couple of minutes to do, and it really helps in the overall exposure of the show so that those who would be interested in listening can find it more easily. Thank you, thank you, thank you for being here today, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Earn Your Spurs podcast. Until next time, happy trails and spur on.